Investors Chronicle.
Well, hello out there to all our listeners. This is the IC Companies and Markets podcast for this week. My name is Mark Robinson. I'm filling in for Dan Jones, who is off on a well-deserved break. But I'm not on my own, which is good. I'm joined by my colleagues, Dave Baxter, Julian Hoffman, Chris Ackers, and all under the watchful gaze of our producer, Madeline Apthorpe. Now, we'll be looking at this week's cover feature shortly. I'll be speaking to Dave about that, and that's Britain's top-rated funds as picked by analysts. This should be interesting for our listeners out there because there are specific recommendations. We obviously can't go over too many of them today, but Dave will be highlighting some trends in the market. After which I'll be speaking to Julian about a specific result for Vanquis Banking, but on a broader note about the state of alternative financing. And lastly, I'll be speaking to Chris about two drinks companies that target opposite ends of the consumer spectrum, Fever Tree Drinks and AG Barr, both of which released results this week. And there's some similarities there as well as a few differences. Firstly, I think we'll just have a quick rundown of some of the news stories that are prominent. This morning it emerged that Thames Water could be at risk of being nationalised after it failed to secure a £500 million lifeline that was withheld. And the question there is obviously if this could be seen as a prelude to a wider debt-related issues in the sector. I mean, we've been warning for some time about the level of leverage in the utility sector generally, and this will get some analysts interested today, no doubt about that at all. This week, there's a few interesting other developments. Donald Trump's Truth Social site, or the holding company, went public and attracted about an $8 billion rating, which was slightly annoying in terms of his political adversaries. Those eyebrows obviously raised at the valuation put on, I think it's called Digital World Acquisition, the holding vehicle. It's a shell company, really. But then again, we shouldn't, you know, we won't be too surprised about the ratings giving over to tech startups. I mean, you know, it's sort of blue sky stuff, really, for the most part. There was more solid news, really. Ithaca Energy looks like it may become the UK's biggest North Sea oil and gas operator after it inked an agreement with Italy's Eni over a few sites there, which is good news for shareholders, I would imagine. Tom Hayes failed in his legal appeal linked to the LIBOR controversy, which was about 10 years ago, I suppose. The appeal was rejected by the Court of Appeal in London and upheld the guilty verdict that was handed to Mr. Hayes, who's formerly Citigroup trader. What was interesting about that, I'm sure as you remember, is that it was a bit of a, it wasn't necessarily a hammer blow, but it didn't do anything for London's reputation in terms of financial probity. The Bank of England has warned of the risk to UK businesses from the private equity bubble. Again, this is something that's been covered in the magazine in the past. You know, the bank average highlighted leverage issues, transparency and valuations. Private equity has bought in heavily into the UK, and just on the supermarket front, you think of Asda and Morrison's. Higher interest rates have already scuppered a lot of investments from private equity over the last 12 months or so. But one gets the impression that the worst of it has yet to play out. Again, it's something that we need to be aware of going forward. Lastly, Unilever looks like it's going to be spinning off its ice cream arm there. There's projections of a £13 billion listing. Obviously, the board at Unilever probably have had enough of dealing with superannuated hippies And so that listing, unfortunately, looks like it could be heading the way of the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, but I don't know if that's been confirmed yet, but it would be bad news for London again. Okay, that's all the news that's fit to print for this week. And so we're going to have a discussion now about this week's cover feature, Britain's top rated funds as picked by analysts. Now, this has been written by Moira O'Neill, who is an old IC stager, one of the UK's most respected personal finance journalists, and a noted classicist, if I remember correctly. The feature sets out best buy lists from a lot of the main investment platforms, namely AJ Bell, Barclays, Smart Investor, Best Invest, Charles Stanley, Direct, Hargreaves Lansdowne, Interactive Investor, and Fidelity. And it also sets out the 14 most recommended funds as well. And I guess it's worth examining whether any trends are evident in the recommendations. It's odd that out of nearly 400 funds, only 63 received two or more recommendations, leaving a rump of 290-odd funds with only one recommendation each. You know, the question is whether we should necessarily be surprised on this. You know, most platforms don't agree on 74% of the recommendations, which Moira believes is interesting in itself. But I don't know, I'm not quite sure mathematically whether that makes much sense or otherwise. I might bring in Dave now, because this is his particular area of expertise. Dave, what are the trends that these results seem to highlight, or are there any trends?
Yeah, so there are a few. I mean, as you mentioned, there's a kind of interesting, I suppose, dispersal and difference of opinion among platforms, which might relate to the fact there are just so many funds out there nowadays. There are thousands available. There are, even though active funds don't always do that well, there are good options. And they may have different methodologies and want to differentiate themselves from each other when they're kind of picking interesting funds. So there is that. I suppose in terms of kind of other trends, obviously the list is quite, you know, disparate, but we are seeing an interesting mix of kind of options. You're seeing lots of kind of passive funds are still kind of cropping up there, which I suppose kind of reinforces the idea that a lot of investors can do well with just kind of a sort of core exposure from a tracker of kind of the main markets. Another interesting trend is, I suppose, a kind of absence. So Moira sort of did similar analysis about a year ago, and there was a small presence of kind of investment trusts in the list, but this year there are no investment trusts. It's kind of hard to tell exactly why that might be. You know, it is quite a difficult period for trusts at the minute. You've seen lots of consolidation, lots of kind of share price weakness and that kind of thing. So it's quite a disruptive space for investors to be in. But there are still lots of kind of good options that haven't really made it in there, though some do appear in sort of separate recommendations.
The point that you made before that, you know, I found interesting is the methodology behind this too, because, yeah, you know, conceivably fund managers approach this from a different perspectives, and that might explain the apparent disparity of the overall results.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what's interesting is platforms, when they're compiling these lists, will kind of look at some different metrics. So, you know, one metric that has become more important in the wake of the kind of Neil Woodford scandal a few years ago is things like liquidity and, you know, whether a fund seems to be managed well in that respect and won't run into kind of problems with illiquid assets. So that's one metric that some might use more than others. And then there are things like consistency of process and kind of performance and how much emphasis you put on past performance and other metrics. So I guess it's just useful if you're an investor kind of looking at these lists for inspiration, it's just very useful to actually dig into the lists look at what the platforms are prioritizing. And then normally with those lists, they do kind of have reasonably detailed explanations of their rationale for, you know, kind of featuring that fund over something else. So it can just help you kind of inform your own initial research there.
Yeah, I guess in a sense, as always with investors, it helps to ask that, go back to first principles. What are you hoping to achieve with your investment portfolio yourself? And that's going to differ from person to person. So in a sense, I guess, the disparity within that overall research is understandable on that basis. Did you find that there was any overlap with the top 50 funds list?
There is some overlap, perhaps limited, but there is a bit. So, for example, if you look at the kind of top 14 funds by kind of shared appearances in Best Buy lists, there are four names that also feature in our top 50 list. I won't give everything away, but just mention one perhaps. As a fund called BlackRock European Dynamic, that's a very kind of, as the name suggests, quite a flexible fund. They're not really wedded to one particular investment style, but they kind of they like kind of undervalued stocks with good growth prospects, and they take quite concentrated, chunky positions as well. So they can, they got hit really hard in 2022, and that was the big kind of bear market, but generally they've tended to kind of post some quite good returns, and that's been a very kind of solid fund. But yeah, again, I mean, the fact that there's still reasonably limited overlap with kind of our list and those lists shows the, I suppose, the point we're making, that you can approach these things very differently, and there are very different ways to kind of value or prefer a fund.
Yeah, I guess that time frame element as well is significant. Now, if I go back a few years, and ordinarily if you had this period as we have, where there's been a sharp increase and a prolonged increase in interest rates, you might be looking towards the old-fashioned special situations funds as well, but they seem to have gone by the wayside to a certain degree, possibly because we had that lengthy period of sort of, or, well, not negative interest rates, but near as damn it. So, you know, those type of wider effects as well are often brought to bear. So what would you be a recommendation for our readers and listeners, for that matter, when they approach this feature? Where does it have some value for them?
I think it's useful for getting some initial ideas. So if you're considering certain regions, then you can kind of look, or certain asset classes like bonds, you can look at the funds that are cropping up, and they might kind of be potential options to research. I suppose a converse approach to that is, it might show up some of those funds that are potentially kind of crowded trades, because, you know, funds can become too big or too popular. So that can be something to bear in mind as well. But it's just a good starting point. But I think your points about remembering kind of what kind of investor you are, what time frames you have, you know, what's your appetite to risk, and what are you actually looking for? Do you want something simple? Do you just want trackers? Do you want to kind of target specific or focus on specific scenarios or markets? Those are all things that you need to bear in mind. And then you can perhaps look through this list, and it can just give you some inspiration, and it can be perhaps the first step in your own research. And you then need to do much, I suppose, much more diligence on the funds and kind of what fits in with your portfolio.
Okay, that's fine. A bespoke approach then. Maury's done a great job anyway, and I'm sure it's going to be of particular interest to our readership too, perhaps even more so for those moving away from the traditional 60-40 split. Anyway, thank you, Dave. We're going to move on now to the second topic this week, and it relates to results for Vanquis Banking, formerly Provident Financial, and they were covered by Julian Hoffman, and I think we can also talk about the state of alternate financing as a link to this story too. So, Julian, could you just explain some of the regulatory problems that are facing Vanquis? So it might help to give a potted history of the company as well.
Yes, Vanquis Bank, everyone's favourite doorstep lender with menaces, allegedly. It used to be Provident Financial, which in its day was a halfway respectable higher interest rate lender. That was one of those companies that lent to people without credit history, or if you'd gone bankrupt, you could get some sort of card from them. Or if you didn't have a bank account, they were another one of those that service that, you know, that section of the market of which there are unfortunately quite a few people in the UK who don't have access to a bank account. It's well over, I think, 2 million. So quite high. So they had this model where they employed lots of self-employed people to collect the money that they were due every month from their customers, and they would literally go doorstep to doorstep, usually on a Thursday because that's benefits payout day.
And usually with a baseball bat, or was that...
I think the baseball bat in this case was optional.
Oh, okay.
As far as I know. So, yes, they had this doorstep lending model. There was some fretting a few years ago that this wasn't any more regulatory compliant. Although, interestingly, the FSA itself at the time, FCA itself at the time, didn't make a lot of comment about it. But they felt that they were not going to be allowed to continue with that very sort of successful but quite 19th, almost like early 20th century model of lending. So Vanquis has tried, is the successor company to Provident, and that is more like a conventional, at least the way that it runs its business is more conventional than employing people to walk around housing estates.
Well, presumably with Provident as well, that type of model would have been reflected in the net interest rate too.
The interest rate they charge is astronomical. If you have a Vanquis card, it can be anywhere up to 70%,
okay,
or APR, which I think is relatively generous in that space. But yeah, it does offer people who have had credit problems in their lifetime the opportunity of rebuilding their scores or getting back into onto the ladder. So it's a perfectly legitimate exercise. But they make the measure of how profitable this is that their net interest margin is over 19%. Whereas if you are a conventional bank, you'll be lucky, even with higher interest rates, to make 3%.
Yeah, I guess conventional banks are struggling enough now, but partly related to capital constraints or demands. They keep a certain amount of, or an increased amount of their capital. That wouldn't necessarily be such an issue for Vanquis, would it? Or are they suffering on the same basis?
They're not suffering from... The capital isn't really when you're charging such high percentage rates, your balance sheet reflects risk rather than the cost of funding.
Yeah.
So that service, they charge a premium for that service because in their view, they're taking a much greater risk than a bank would on the same customer.
Okay.
So that's how that model works. They're not as regulated, not as tied into how much regulated capital they need to keep on hand and things like that. So there are certain advantages that Vanquis has. The problem is that they seem to struggle to maintain their profitability, and a lot of that has to do with legacy claims against the business. So they've got people are coming forward saying they've been overcharged X percentage on their loans over the years, and they have to be investigated. The company says that for the most part the cases are dismissed, but there is a sort of operational cost in dealing with that legacy. So so every time the results come around, it's always a case of how many customers have we had to pay out or deal with this quarter or this half, and that at the moment seems to be what's determining the profitability. So the question really, the broader question for investors is whether the business as it stands is going to be viable enough to continue as a a lending operation in the way it's organized. I mean, the best that the analysts can say about it at the moment is that there was no more bad news coming out of the results, which, you know, is if the best, if that's the best you can say, is not a, a ringing endorsement. But, you know, there is a, there is an opportunity to recover. I mean, they have a, yeah, there is a niche for that service. I mean, it may not, it may not be the one that most people are familiar with, but yeah, people do rely on very high cost credit, and if they can get their regulatory act together, then because they're earning such high margins on the capital they need, there is a possibility that they could become more, much more profitable. But we are talking 2 or 3 years down the line, I would say.
So they're also trading at a considerable discount to net assets as well. Do you think that's justified, or is it a sign of weakness, or a sign of a mispriced asset?
Well, it's probably a sign of the weakness of the operating model. If you mean, if you can't remain profitable just because a few people are making claims against you, then you have an issue with how the business is run, I would say, which is probably why there's that massive discount. But I mean, we're not talking about a situation that's on, you know, sudden. I mean, this has been an ongoing problem for several years, that they've been trying to change their way they operate from what was a tried and tested model to something which, you know, imitates at least in part what other banks do, but without really being a conventional bank themselves. So, you know, it's like they've got the hassle of one, the hassle of being a bank, but without the benefits of being.
Yeah. Well, I guess you get a situation anyway with that. It might, act as a barrier to entry in a sense. But listen, thanks very much for that.
I mean, there's not many, I mean, there are generally not many subprime lenders in the UK. I mean, it's quite a niche market, but it's not a well-served one. So you had briefly the likes of Wonga and this kind of payday lender types. Yeah. Until they more or less got regulated out of existence. If Vanquis can sort of pull clear of its operational issues, then it does have the opportunity to dominate the market. So, you know, you've got to, the key question really for investors, you know, where is the knife? How far has the knife fallen?
Yeah.
And are you in a position, would they be in a position to pick up the value when that market dominance comes back, you know?
Oh, well, there we have it.
I don't know. I mean, it's just one of those things. It's a potentially interesting business, but it needs to get out. It just needs to get away from its legacy. Really.
It's a vestige of the subprime era, in essence, as well. So, it's certainly an interesting case study. I'm not sure about its investment potential, but we'll come back to it at some point in the future. But thanks very much for that, Julian, an informed view on the company. Lastly, we're going to come to slightly more conventional organisations. Two of the UK's prominent beverage producers, Fevertree Drinks and AG Bar. The former was famous, I guess, because it rode on the back of the premiumisation boom, which is a horrible word, no doubt the result of marketers. But, you know, the basic story went, they introduced a capital light business model that exploits this consumer switch away in favour of high-end spirits. The logic runs that if people are prepared to pay an extra £10 for a bottle of spirits, why wouldn't they pay an extra pound or two for a suitable mixer? The other company, of course, AG Bar, is the producer of Iron Brew, who's Scotland's alternative national drink. So on the line, we've got Chris Akers about this. Chris, can we just go to Fevertree first, if we could. One of the things that I thought that was interesting about the result itself is that the US has become more and more prominent as time has gone on.
Yeah, that's right. So the US is now the company's biggest revenue generator after the UK and Europe. US revenue up by over a fifth in the latest year, and the company spoke about the performance being helped by strong off-trade growth, but also some distribution gains in the on-trade. Introduction of products in can formats also seemed to go down pretty well with US consumers. And it does seem like there's a lot of potential for future growth in the US. But I suppose looking at the results as a whole, that was the good news in terms of revenue. Trading was less impressive across other markets. You had flat revenue in the UK, growth of only 4% in Europe, and revenue fell 14% in the sort of quite small rest of the world division. I mean, the view we've taken on Fevertree is definitely enough to keep investors interested in the investment case. The company is forecasting sort of progress with revenue and margin this year, although we are remaining neutral for valuation reasons, as we'll come to in a bit.
I remember reading some time ago that the US market is slightly different for Fevertree drinks, in as far as that they're seen as, you know, standalone soft drinks rather than necessarily mixers, which, you know, might actually help their expansion over there too. One feature that we did anticipate was that the gross margin was under pressure. Could you explain why that was during the year and whether that's been alleviated to any degree?
Yeah, so the company's really struggled with inflationary pressures over the last couple of years, with higher glass, packaging, ingredients costs coming alongside higher energy and freight costs as well, and that's all combined to hit margins pretty badly. There is evidence that cost headwinds are now going into reverse, so the margin improved in the second half of the latest year, but overall it was down by 240 basis points to about 32%. And the company is anticipating the gross margin will rise by about 6% in the current financial year, which sounds very good. But even if that was to happen, the margin would still be below the over 40% level seen in 2021. So it's very much in margin recovery mode at the moment.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that attracted investors initially was the fact that it does have this capital light business model. So its demands on that basis aren't as pronounced as other people in the same space. But of course, you know, that was shown up to be, well, not necessarily not the way forward, but the fact when raw material costs started increasing dramatically, particularly in relation to glass manufacture, which is very energy intensive, the company had to bear those costs as well. So with sort of the benefits of that capital light model are no longer quite so in evidence. So looking at the rating, we've been trading at 32 times forward earnings. Is this realistic given the growth potential, or is it still a little bit on the lofty side?
Yeah, so I think it's definitely still on the lofty side. It's worth mentioning that since result, they've actually gotten a bit more expensive. So they're now trading at about 36 times forward earnings, which isn't that much cheaper than the five-year average of 43 times. I think this is definitely a hangover from early excitement on the company. And I mean, there are signs of recovery and growth potential, but the valuation is expensive, and that's a key reason why we're staying neutral for now. There's an analyst at Liberum this week pointed out Fevertree is trading at a big premium to some other drinks peers like Campari and Remy Cointreau. So racing's expensive despite signs of recovery.
Okay, we'll have to wait round till that comes back to more realistic levels then. We'll just move on quickly now to AG Barr, a company that you're no doubt quite familiar with, Chris. Their chief or long-standing chief executive, Roger White, he announced his departure from the group this week as well. Or actually, I think it may well have been foreshadowed, that one too. It was a decent outing, judging by the sales figures. And the chairman of the company, Mark Allen, pointed out that under his leadership, Mr. White's turned AG Barr into what was a small regional player into, I think the quote is, a highly successful multi-beverage branded company. Have you got any comments in there as well? You would have seen that development at close hand, I imagine.
Yes. So it's worth mentioning that the Roger White stepping down was announced some time ago, so that wasn't a surprise for investors. But it's obviously a big moment for the company. He's been there for a long time. He is leaving behind an impressive legacy, I'd say. So the weighted revenue performance, revenue of around 400 million, was 150 million up on pre-pandemic levels. So it's quite impressive growth. Iron Brew remains the core product and what the company is known for. But White's has overseen some pretty interesting acquisitions over the last couple of years. And that's really expanded the company's product range. And he guided the business through the pandemic. very well. So it's, yeah, it's been an impressive tenure, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, the product offering itself is developed, and it's been certainly successful in terms of the top line, these results indicate. But there's been some margin pressure as a result of integration issues. Could you set those out, please, Chris?
Yeah, so the adjusted operating margin was down by 130 basis points, 12.3% in the latest year. The company pointed to, quote, production insourcing, end quote, on the Bist drinks and Rio acquisitions. Just to mention, Bist was an energy drink acquisition and Rio the tropical drink acquisition. But the margin performance was actually a bit better than the company had anticipated earlier in the year. And it's actually quite bullish about rebuilding margins over the next 2 years. So I'd say sort of short-term pain when it comes to margin.
So, you know, it's been subject to the same kinds of pressures linked to raw material costs as well, but possibly in a bit of a better position than Fever-Tree. Well, thank you very much for that, Chris. And of course, we wish Roger White all the best in his retirement. That about wraps it up for this week as well. And I guess I should apologise in retrospect, because unfortunately, London is blanketed in a fog of pollen at the moment. That's why my voice has progressively gone more and more towards that of Louis Armstrong. But again, thanks very much for listening. And Dan, we'll be back next week for our next podcast. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.